And what I did is I built the active E-field probe. Then they were actually utilizing kind of a printed circuit board, and the amplifier transistor biased up as that high current level as possible to obtain the best performance in RF in especially dense urban environment for that purpose. So, that's for the attention of others more knowledgeable. I really don't have that knowledge. But my question is for clarification. We have 17 kilohertz, we have 73 kilohertz, we have 136 kilohertz, and 160 and to 190. Which of these bands are still available? Back to you.
Yeah, later on I'm going to have some comments about the E-probe antenna. It sounds like only one of those bands is really available to the United States. Is that approximately your recollection, Lou? W2JPW, wait for the four beeps, Q2RIW.
That's correct. I've been in touch with the League about this. When they were considering 136 KC, I got the proposal that the League had sent to the FCC. They'll have it here somewhere. I don't know what they did with it. And that was turned down by the because of objection from the power companies. I can sort of understand why they objected, because that particular frequency here is loaded with subcarriers from their telemetry on the power lines here. I don't know what they do in Europe, but that's what they do here. And I don't know anything. 70 kilohertz was thought of, but the book here says this book I recommended to you, LF Today, says that that's defunct. But they don't give any details on it. And I wasn't aware that any lower frequency than that, like 15 or 20 kilohertz, was even thought of. How would you ever radiate anything on that? You see the size of the antennas that they use in the Navy uses for those bands. They're enormous. So the only band that I think is available, from what I've gotten from the ARRL and reading the various comments on it, I've sort of kept up with it because I've always been very interested in those frequencies. I don't know why, I just am. I listen down there every once in a while. Is 600 meters, 500 kilohertz. That's the only one that's in play right now. Go ahead.
Mel recognized. Common sense would lead you to believe, Lou, that you would like to make the antenna a half wavelength long to be a dipole, a quarter wavelength long to be a ground plane. We amateurs tend to think in dipole voltage-like antennas. There's a whole class of antennas called loop antennas that do a beautiful job, even though they could be extremely small in wavelength of diameter. So a loop antenna, and maybe multiple turns to the loop in some cases, can do an extremely good job for receiving and not a bad job from transmitting, even though the loop might be 0.1 or 0.05 wavelengths in diameter, and that can be an extremely good radiator. So it's just a matter of shifting our thinking. As long as you've used low resistivity materials to make that loop out of, as long as you've done a fairly good job of impedance matching between your transmitter, so that now a majority of your available 1 watt of power, if that's what you're allowed to use, if the majority of that 1 watt is getting into that loop, and the loop is resonating at your frequency, it will radiate it into space. So it's not quite as bad as you think. Let's see if Mel, here's a guy who's using a full wavelength 80 meter loop, but I'll bet you he's used lower frequency antennas. K2KEY. K2RIW, go ahead, Mel.
No, I was just curious. During World War II, when amateur radio was, of course, shut down, there were a number of hams that were operating on these carrier, so-called carrier current piece of equipment. And after World War II, they were marketed as, you know, wireless intercom. In other words, you wanted an intercom from downstairs to upstairs in your house. All you had to do was plug it into the AC line. Now, I was wondering, what frequency did they operate on? I remember seeing a couple of, three or four, two intercom units, Dick. They were very popular, I can say, back in the 40s. What the heck was the story on those? They were going over the, over the AC lines, over.
For very short distances, and if you're smart enough, you can put any frequency you like on that AC line. The college I went to for a short period of time did have a carrier current radio station on campus running at 550 kilohertz, the low end of the AM dial. It was an AM broadcast station, and I think it ran 1 watt. As long as at the perimeter of your campus, you don't exceed part 15, I think it's called part 15 of the FCC rules, which is something like 15 microvolts per meter. As long as, even though you're on a broadcast frequency, as long as you've got control of that multiple acres that you call campus, and you can radiate anything you want on that campus, as long as the signal leaving the perimeter of the campus is low enough in amplitude that it's not interfering with other services and other people outside of the campus. So whether you did it on 550 kilohertz or 55 kilohertz is your choice. You may have a little bit more difficulty coupling the signal with the right kind of an RF choke, if you know what I mean, at 55 kilohertz into the power line, but every one of those frequencies will work. So when it comes to these carrier current intercom-like systems in your house, I don't know if it comes under FCC. Yeah, it does come under Part 15 of the FCC rules as to far as how much signal in microvolts per meter 3 meters away from the wire, how strong is that signal allowed to be. As long as you meet those rules, it can be a non-licensed system. I wonder if anyone has any comments on this. Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
I don't forget that you were trying to comment on the E-field antenna.
Yeah, there's a whole class of antennas that are used for receiving only, which are called antennifiers, they're called E-field probes, they get lots of different names. But with a field effect transistor, you choose the right JFET or MOSFET or whatever, the input impedance can be zillions of megohms of input impedance. As such, a tiny little whisker of wire, 18 inches long or whatever, hanging on that gate of that FET transistor, and that piece of wire hanging in the air, absolutely positively not anything near a resonant length. It will tell you what that signal is coming through the air. See, the majority of antennas work on the philosophy of energy transfer. When I transmit into an antenna, I'm transferring energy from my transmitter through that antenna and into the ether, into the air, into the ionosphere, into the atmosphere. And most of the antennas that we use do the same thing. They take some amount of energy out of the air, impedance match it to 50 ohms, and apply that power, even though it's microwatts, nanowatts, picowatts, but it applies it to your receiver. Your receiver's got 120 dB of gain. After all that gain and after the proper processing, that signal comes out of the loudspeaker and you hear the information that's on there, whether it be Morse code or audio or television or whatever. So most of the antennas are real energy transducers. But there's a whole class of antennas that are not very well known. Let me drop. Which do not absorb energy. An E-field probe is one of those. It senses the fact that an E-field in the atmosphere is present, but it does not absorb any measurable amount of power. Let me compare that to something that you're more familiar with. If I was using a Simpson or triplet volt-ohm milliammeter, and this was 1960, that's the best thing I can get a hold of, and the most sensitive meter you and I could buy in those days, the meter movement itself, of any reliability was 50 microamp meter movement, 50 microamps full scale. The 50 microamps full scale, and the fact that that meter simply changed the series resistance in order to make it the 3-volt scale or the 30-volt scale or the 300-volt scale, that means that the whole Don triplet or Simpson was 20,000 ohms per volt. You tell me what scale you're on. If you're on the 3-volt scale, 20,000 ohms per volt times 3 is 60,000 ohms. I know that that meter is going to create a 60,000 ohm load on whatever I connect it to. So if I'm measuring a very delicate circuit, like the automatic gain control voltage of an old-fashioned tube receiver, and the AGC voltage had an impedance of megohms, and you put a 60,000 ohm load resistor on it called volt-ohm milliammeter, and you rapidly discover that connecting the meter to that probe, to that point on the receiver, drastically changes the voltage that was there, drastically changes the characteristics of the receiver. You've loaded down a delicate portion of the receiver with your volt-ohm milliammeter, because your volt-ohm milliammeter is really sucking power out of the circuit, and that is the power that moves that meter movement. That was 1960. Now this is the year two.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Now we jump ahead to the year 2000. Every self-respecting guy these days is using a digital voltmeter. The digital voltmeter has a field effect transistor in its front end, or an operational amplifier that's acting like it. And the digital voltmeter, no matter what scale you're on, presents an impedance of almost exactly 10 megohms. 10 megohms is a number so big that it's an extremely rare circuit where that digital voltmeter is going to load down the circuit. So all of a sudden, because of the active amplification that's in that digital voltmeter, it's got a 9-volt power supply that you put in there. It's got a 9-volt transistor radio battery in there. That's what's running the electronics. Because of the electronic amplification, that digital voltmeter, your DVM, does not load down the circuit. It sucks no power out of the circuit. It senses the fact that an E-field is there, but doesn't really disturb it. An E-probe antenna does exactly that. So it doesn't have to be resonant. It tells you what signal is there. It amplifies that signal and eventually sends it through your receiver and into your loudspeaker. That's the good news. The good news is that the one antenna, because of its active amplification, it does not obey reciprocity. You cannot transmit through that antenna. You can receive beautifully. If I wanted to build a receiver to receive a 17 kilohertz radio signal, that's about as low as you can get. A very young set of ears can actually hear that carrier, if you know what I mean, 17 kilohertz, as a radio signal going through the air. I could build a simple antenna with an E-field probe that receives that. Transmitting is another thing. I'll have to use some kind of a loop antenna. And the loop antenna does suck power out of the environment, but the E-field probe doesn't. Maybe this helps some. N2XJN, K2LIW in the ZECNAT.
Actually, I'm reading that this particular E-field antenna made by Amrat was the amplifier transistor. It was biased up to the high current level as possible to obtain the best performance in RF, and the result is the heat sink that is made out of the piece of copper water pipe. If you can comment on that.
I heard somebody, see, because I'm listening on the input, I heard somebody sign in from Pennsylvania. But the Pennsylvania station, although you're giving me a nice signal here on Long Island, you have to have a 136.5 hertz PL tone in order to come through the repeater. So add the 136.5 hertz PL tone, and you can join the conversation. And by the way, Lou, you put a beautiful signal into our repeater from Allendale, New Jersey. I should know. Tell me roughly how many miles are you from the repeater, and what are you using to put it, to give us such a beautiful signal from New Jersey? And do you get any local QR Mary from the Frenchtown repeater that's on the exact same frequency. W2JPW, wait for the four beeps, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, so I'm running a 46 FM here, so I'm running about close to 100 watts, I guess. I want that for this distance. We're about 30 miles from you, I guess. I don't really know. We're 20 miles from New York City, and you're about 8 or 10 miles from New York City or more. So we're fairly high up here, about 120 feet or so. So I don't know the exact distance, Dick. Back to you, Glenn.
The antenna you're using is how high up? And you said you're putting 100 watts into it? Is it a vertical ground plane? You're doing very well. I'm going to have to tell people to copy JPW when they want to get in from New Jersey. Over to you for a quickie on that one, Lou.
It's an old diamond vertical. It's it's a collinear. It's one typical transmitting antenna like you see so many places. It's got a white radome. It's 2-3 half waves in phase. Go ahead.
Okay, that's a real antenna. And how many feet is that above the ground, Lou?
About 20 feet.
Okay, that's a good altitude. Now, let's see. Where were we before all this? So, we now know that an E-field antenna, there are 5,000 kinds of antennas, and I'm not kidding. You take the average kid, the average young engineer, fresh out of a good electrical engineering school, where he has specialized in radio communication circuits as his major. I've done this many times. And you ask him, how many kinds of antennas are there in the world? It'll say, 20, 30. Most of them are bent up pieces of wire. They really believe that. You open up any of the four editions of the Antenna Engineering Handbook by McGraw-Hill, and the latest one is broken up into something like 50 separate chapters, where each chapter is a class of antennas, and each of those chapters have a whole lot of subclasses. There's lots of antennas. And know that all of those antennas you see are the direct antennas, and almost every one of them has a duality antenna. Every piece of metal you put in space that you call an antenna has a duality. You can do the exact opposite. Where you had free insulated space before, you act a sheet of metal. And where you had a piece of metal before, you put a slot. So you do the exact opposite. Can trade off conductor for non-conductor on both the insulation around the antenna as well as the antenna itself. And the antenna comes out again with identical gain, identical pattern, but just that the E and the H are reversed. In other words, if the old antenna happened to be horizontal polarized, the new one will be vertically polarized. But other than that, there's a whole set of dualities. I'm not even counting the dualities when I tell you there's 5,000 kinds. But a whole subclass of antennas are the E-field probes.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And the E-field probe antennas, as long as you've got a modern-day high-impedance amplifying device right at the antenna, and no feed line in general, as far as the antenna connects not to a feed line, but to the amplifying device. Once you decide to use that, the antenna can be on any frequency you want, almost DC to light, and I'm not kidding. I've known of an article that was in Ham Radio Magazine of an E-field probe antenna that ran from a few hundred kilohertz to 1,000 megahertz inclusive. And that was an E-field probe antenna. Ham Radio Magazine showed you a beautiful picture of this thing and how to build it. Very simple. The nice thing about those antennas is, as a receiving device, they can go to any frequency you want. They absorb no energy from the environment. They have no radar cross-section. Every real antenna you and I put up, if I got the right kind of electronics, I know you've got an antenna, because I can aim a signal at your antenna and see the echo that it makes. Your perfectly impedance matched dipole that you've got on a 100-foot high piece of tower, of all the energy that hits that antenna. The laws of physics dictate that half the energy gets absorbed with perfect impedance match and it goes down the feed line, and the other half gets re-radiated into space. It has a radar cross-section. You put that antenna on a stealthy airplane, and that airplane is going to show up on somebody's radar screen. They can't do that. I think, I'm not quite sure what the question was that we're addressing right now. Back to you, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
N2XJN. I believe that I'm done with this question. If you think like we can go to the University of Michigan and solar power without solar cells, a hidden magnetic effect of the light that could make it possible, and the underestimated magnetic component of the light within the glass happened to be the amplified of 100 million of times. And that is quite new approach to photovoltaic and also to energy. And I wonder also if you had a chance to look at the emails. There was a picture of the device made by the cop and us, and I'm going to go further to that, but let's first discuss that. Back to you.
Okay, I wasn't aware that you were about to change to another subject. Let me go back and finish the subject that I started before Lou came back. And that was this discussion that Lou and I, that Len, K2IBX, and I had earlier this week. And what we're talking about is I'm trying to combine two antennas. I don't own a power divider. I want to do it as a quick experiment. And I just simply take the two cables, combine them with a simple T-connector, the 250-ohm antennas at the center of the T-connector make 25 ohms, and I now run 25 ohms as a load on the rest of the transmission line back to the shack, which is a 50-ohm transmission line. What happens when you do that? The average amateur will say, that's not going to work. You've got too big an impedance mismatch, and the signals are going to be bouncing back and forth in funny ways. Everybody believes that. Works like a charm. You get very little loss from reality, and it's not obvious as to why. I once entered an antenna gain contest where, in a pinch, I wanted to combine two antennas. This is one of these measurements in the field that we used to do at Trenton State College back in the early days when everybody started losing faith in the data sheet that was supplied by manufacturers of antennas. Let me drop. So Dr. Alan Katz, K2UIH, and his right-hand buddy, Paul Wade, WA2ZZF, was his call letters in those days. Now it's W1GHZ, gigahertz. Anyhow, Paul Wade and Alan Katz would run these antenna gain competitions starting in 1968, and they ran on for at least 15 or 20 years. Every year, guys from three, four, or five states would get together. These are guys on 432 and 1296. They would get together and measure commercial antennas and homebrew antennas. And throughout those 15 or so years, 90-some-odd percent of the time, the winning antenna, the antenna demonstrating in a field on a measurement, on an antenna range, so-called traceable to the Bureau, we measured the real gain of these antennas, and 90-some-odd percent of the time, the winning antenna was a homebrew antenna by amateurs, and some of the commercial antennas came up with some really terrible performance. There's a very popular brand of antenna at the time that was complaining, that was claiming it had 16 or 17 dB of gain, and it measured 7. There was another one that claimed 24 dB of gain. It measured 7.5. You know, huge differences. This is part of the reason why, for the last 20 or so years, QST Magazine, all antennas in their magazine, all antenna advertisements, will not tell you the manufacturer's claim for gain in decibels. They don't tell you gain above isotropic or gain above dipole. They don't tell you of gain, because they realized the vast majority of those people were fibbing, very strongly fibbing. The gain of those antennas was being set in the advertising department, not in the measurement laboratory. So during one of these antenna game competitions, I wanted to combine two antennas and be competitive. And I did it with a simple T-connector. A bunch of people came along and said, you can't do that. That's going to die. Well, it worked like a charm. That particular antenna won that particular year. Let me drop. And now let me show you what's going on. There's two ways of looking at your transmitting amplifier, the final stage of your transmitter. You could assume it's a 50-ohm source, and if you were using a balanced amplifier, a transistorized balanced amplifier, which has got two separate amplifiers being combined with a quadrature hybrid, it is a 50-ohm source. And if you were using that kind of a transmitter, you could make yourself an equivalent diagram where you've got a black box, you've got an ideal voltage generator inside the box, with a 50-ohm series resistor going to the output connector. The ideal voltage generator, if you ask it to produce 2 volts, it produces 2 volts no matter what load it sees. That's an ideal voltage generator. And the 50-ohm resistor in series with that, going to the output connector, ensures that the transmitter at all frequencies will be an exact 50-ohm load, 50-ohm source. Ordinarily, you put a 50-ohm load on that. You didn't realize it, but there's really a 2-to-1 voltage drop happening. If there was a 2-volt signal on that internal signal generator, a 2-volt signal, some portion of it flows through the internal 50-ohm resistor, goes to the output connector. Now you've put a 50-ohm load on the output side. So you've got a 50-ohm resistor on the inside, a 50-ohm resistor on the outside, the load, and they're in series with each other. That is a 2-to-1 voltage divider. If the signal generator inside was producing 2 volts, your load will see exactly 1 volt if it's a 50-ohm load. That's the starting position. Now I've made this crazy adaptation where I have put two antennas in parallel with a T-connector. I have created a 25-ohm load. By definition, on a 50-ohm transmission line, that is a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. But let's figure out what happens when we do this. Let me drop. I've now got a 25-ohm load on the output of this black box I'm describing, which has got a 50-ohm input resistor, 50-ohm internal impedance resistor, let's call it. And in my example, the signal generator internal ideal voltage generator is still generating 2 volts. The 2 volts used to divide 2-to-1, 1 volt out, even though you're generating 2 volts internally. Now, because I've got a 25-ohm load on that series 50-ohm resistor, I've now got a 3-to-1 voltage divider. Of the 2 volts that's being generated, only 1/3 of it gets to my output. I only get where I used to have 1 volt, I've now got, I think it's 6/10 of a volt, if I understand correctly. Yes. You and I know that real power delivered is E squared over R. By simple Ohm's law and voltage divider networks, I can calculate exactly what voltage gets there. I can square that voltage and figure out by dividing by the impedance what power I'm going to get. You do that. At first you square the voltage, and because you've got the 3-to-1 divide instead of the 2-to-1 divide, you think you're going to get a much smaller voltage, and after the square you're really going to get a small voltage. But you've got to remember that it's not, that smaller voltage is going into a 25-ohm, not a 50-ohm load. After you do the calculation, you finally find out the power delivered is 0.888 of the power you used to deliver. That's one point. That's a 0.51 dB of loss. And that's exactly what you get in any situation when you've got a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. In theory, it's half a dB of loss. So the fact that you've combined two antennas, let me drop. If the two antennas are identical and properly stacked, two Yagis will say, I've now got twice the number of antennas. I got 3.01 dB, in theory, of more gain capability. But because of the impedance mismatch of dumbly using a type T connector instead of a real power divider, I've lost half a dB of the possible power that could be delivered. I'm 3.01 dB up because there's two antennas. I'm half a dB down. I've got 2.5 dB of gain. That's a beautiful high-performance antenna. In a pinch, as long as your transmitter can tolerate it, I'll admit that some of the modern-day solid-state transmitters are not going to be happy with 2-to-1. The 80 through 10 meter transmitters fall into that category. Most of the VHF transmitters that we use, 6 meters, 2 meters, 432, and so on, 220, they're not very VSWR sensitive. They've got a very rugged final stage. They're only trying to generate 30 or 50 watts, and for the most part, they can tolerate a 2-to-1 VSWR without cutting back in power, without turning themselves off. So, in a pinch, a T connector is a beautiful thing to use. Works like a charm. It's a half a dB down from ideal. Common sense would lead you to believe it should crash and burn. It flies. You'd be amazed how many people don't know that and misunderstand some of those concepts. Anybody have any questions on what you've just heard, give me a call at us right now. K2LIW on the TechNet.
WS2N.
Call recognized. Anyone else? Go ahead with your question or comment, Paul.
Okay. Is this the same theory that when you take a speaker, there's 4 ohms on it, and then I take another speaker and hook it up to the same piece of equipment, and it's 8 ohms, and it still works fine? Or if I take a 2 speakers or 4 speakers, and no matter what I do, I've done it a million times, it comes, the sound always comes through. It's like there's no difference. I mean, there might be some kind of a difference with all the, percentages of dB gain or loss, but, I mean, as far as my ear is concerned, there's no difference. Is it that kind of theory that we're talking about here, that you could switch, you could change to from a 50 to a 25 ohm mode? Get back to you.
Comment.
Yeah, Paul asked quite a few questions, and let me go through those questions first before we expand it with comments. Hi-fi amplifiers are amazingly forgiving for about 2 or 3 reasons. Number one, your amplifier, manufactured by your particular vendor, told you it wants an 8-ohm hi-fi loudspeaker to be connected to it. In my example, 8-ohm impedance loudspeaker. And at the 8-ohm, in theory, it's going to meet all of the specifications for maximum audio power output before it starts distorting. And at that maximum power output, it's going to provide the rated amount of total harmonic distortion. And maybe that was 0.5%. Total harmonic distortion. That means you put an audio spectrum analyzer on it, is one of the ways you could do the test. You could run tones through your audio amplifier from, in theory, 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz. And at each one of those frequencies, you measure the total harmonic distortion that the amplifier creates with that 8-ohm load of that particular loudspeaker. Well, the word 8-ohm load is kind of a funny number. At some of those frequencies, like 1 kilohertz, that loudspeaker will provide an 8-ohm load. You measure that loudspeaker at other frequencies, and you'll find that it's higher and lower than 8 ohms. It's not a constant impedance device. And it's partially a function of what kind of enclosure you put it into, because the speaker itself has some natural resonances. And if you properly married the loudspeaker with its enclosure, in theory, it damps down those resonances so the thing doesn't sound tubby, as they say. Now you come along and you put a pair of 8-ohm loudspeakers on it in parallel. You've created 4 ohms. Or you pick up another loudspeaker that's really 4 ohms and you connect it. At the moderate power level that you normally run...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
At the moderate power level that you normally run your hi-fi amplifier, you're probably running at 10% of its maximum power output capability, because you're not trying to destroy your ears and you're not trying to shake the walls. You're not in the middle of this wedding that's going on, wedding reception, where people like to make the sound so loud that it actually hurts people that are nearby. You're not doing that. As such, if your total harmonic distortion at your low power output went from 0.001% to 0.002%, you can't hear the difference. It sounds beautiful. And it's producing approximately the amount of power you want. See, you can get away with murder with that. And there's another thing going on. I call it the LIPA or the Con Ed situation. In the case of the amplifier I gave in my previous example, I really made a 50-ohm, 7-inch impedance amplifier. It had, in theory, inside that black box, a perfect voltage generator with a perfect series 50 ohm resistor going to its output connector. That's a real 50 ohm impedance signal generator at all reasonable frequencies. And you've now found out that when you put a 50 ohm load on that perfect signal generator, half of all the power it generates is lost internally, and half of it goes, half of the voltage and therefore half of the power, when you have a pure 50 ohm load on the output, half of it goes to the output. If you and I were running Con Ed or Loco, that would be intolerable. For every megawatt that you're delivering to that public out there, you don't want to be dissipating a megawatt. How do they get around that problem? They get around that problem by making the power generator a 100 or a 500 megawatt power generator, and your house, on average, you average the power your house uses over a 24-hour day, the average house uses something in the vicinity of 2 kilowatts. You're a 2 kilowatt load on a signal generator that's got 500 megawatts of capability. You're not even a flea on that elephant, if you know what I mean. You're extremely much.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
That's one factor. And the second factor is because of the way they designed that 500 megawatt signal generator, power generator, they are micro-ohms or nano-ohms of impedance. They are extremely small impedance. And your house at 110 volts and 1,000 watts would be, what would that be? A 10-ohm resistor, I think it is. You're a large number of ohms of load resistor compared to their micro-watt or nano, a micro-ohm or nano-ohm. So in other words, the internal voltage drop on their signal generator is essentially zero. All of the voltage drop is you, the load. That's an ideal way to set up a single generator. Micro-ohms of internal impedance and real ohms of load. To which you're about to say, gee, why don't we make all of our amplifiers that way? There's a catch. Notice what Con Ed or LIPA did. As long as they're generating 500 megawatt of capability, they've got a humongous capability, and you've got, on average, a very small load requirement. Once that ratio is big enough, the laws of physics will allow you to set them up as a micro-ohm or a nano-ohm signal generator, and you're some finite number of ohms, and you get these 99.9% efficiency capability if there wasn't any drop in the power lines going to your house. If you lived close enough to them, the total efficiency could be 99.9% easily of what they generate versus what you get as a load. So as long as you've got this huge ratio of capability compared to load, that's easy. Well, if I want a kilowatt of output, I'm not willing to design a megawatt signal generator to do that, so I can't do that. However, within reason, you can come close. You read the spec sheet on your hi-fi amplifier, and you find out it's got something called damp...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You read the spec sheet on your hi-fi amplifier, and you find out it's got something called damping factor. You're about to ask, what the heck is that? What they've done is that they've made the output audio stage into a great big operational amplifier. It samples the output voltage that's going to your loudspeaker. It compares that voltage to the voltage that came from your audio source. Maybe you're playing in the old days, you're playing a tape recorder. The tape recorder was making a particular sound right now of somebody playing a trumpet. That trumpet sound coming out of the tape recorder had a particular voltage waveform. That voltage waveform was applied to the beginning of that amplifier chain. And the last stage of that amplifier maybe was a 100-watt audio amplifier. But the output of that audio amplifier, a little bit of that voltage was fed back into a comparator circuit. The comparator circuit looked at the voltage that was about to go to your loudspeaker, compared it to the voltage that came out of your tape recorder as a source, and if there was any error, it applied that error with the right polarity to the amplifier to correct for it. So no matter what you put within reason as a load, because it's continuously comparing what goes to your loudspeaker versus what came from your source and correcting for it, you could probably go anywhere from half an ohm of loudspeaker up to 20 ohms of loudspeaker, and you won't hear any difference. you get a slight difference in power output, the amount of audio, which you can readjust by making the volume control go up or down, but the waveform will sound the same because of that comparison. Because of that comparison and feedback, you are really building an up amp. Up until you hit the maximum voltage requirement of that final stage, or the maximum current requirement of that final stage, let me drop. Because of that voltage feedback phenomena, because of that operational amplifier phenomena, up until you hit maximum voltage or maximum current capability, as long as you stay within that range, you look back into that amplifier and you think you're seeing a 0.1 ohm impedance. You're about to say, how in the world, the amplifier is designed to feed an 8 ohm loudspeaker, and I put instrumentation on there, and I look back into that amplifier, and I see 0.1 ohm. Why in the world did they do that? They did that because it creates great fidelity, and it has this factor called damping factor. Because the impedance of the amplifier, when you look back into it, is essentially a short circuit, that gets rid of any resonance that's available, that's present in your loudspeaker. If your loudspeaker wasn't well designed, acoustic suspension we'll say, and if it doesn't have just the right kind of infinite impedance network, what do they call it now, baffle network that you mounted the loudspeaker into, your loudspeaker will have some natural resonances to it. But those resonances, when the loudspeaker is looking into a short circuit, the resonance disappears. Very similar to what happens if you've got a meter movement in your hand and you shake it back and forth. You'll watch the needle fly back and forth and hit the two pegs. Put a short circuit across the meter, which is a magnetic damping circuit, and now you swing the meter back and forth, and the needle doesn't move anymore. As the needle moves, it's trying to generate voltage because it's a moving coil inside of a magnetic field. And you're shorting out that voltage, which stops the meter from moving. You have dampened the meter. You can dampen your loudspeaker the same way. So because of that feedback network, because of the output impedance really being low, and they rate it as something called damping factor, you can see how it's extremely tolerant on what you put on there for loudspeakers. I wonder if that makes some sense to Paul. WS2N.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Okay, this is WS2N. Very good, Dick. Very good explanation. And the only time I've ever really noticed any kind of a difference that you can't swap something out is on these old crystal sets. I've got a couple of them around, and you're supposed to listen through a high impedance, high, 1,000 or 2,000 ohm earphones or an earpiece, and if you hook up an 8 ohm speaker, then all of a sudden it don't work. So that's the only difference. And by the way, a crystal set, I shouldn't, that's really a misnomer. The detector is really a diode in the newer ones that you buy nowadays. It's not an old crystal, although I had one when I was a kid, but they don't seem to sell them with crystals anymore, at least a couple that I have diodes. But they require a high impedance earphone. They work great. But you hook up a speaker and you're dead in the water. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, in the old days, we used to pick up a piece of galena crystal, I think it was called, and you had a thing called a cat whisker that probed it, and if you put the cat whisker in just the right spot, you did get a germanium diode or galena diode, and you put that across the right kind of a loading coil going to a great big long piece of wire in the backyard, you had an AM receiving radio crystal set. The modern day version of that galena and cat whisker is replaced with either a Schottky diode or a 1N34A germanium diode. But in either case, that crystal radio has an impedance of something close to 2,000 ohms, and it produces flea power of audio output. If you live next door to the broadcast station, no problem. But if you're 10 miles from the broadcast station, and you're getting a fraction of a milliwatt of audio out of this thing, and that audio has a 1,000 or 2,000 ohm impedance, and you want to get all of that audio into a set of headphones with good cushions on them that are on your ears, you better use 1,000 or 2,000 ohm headphones. In that particular case, that gives you maximum power transfer and maximum audio if they're a sensitive set of earphones. You connect that to a hi-fi set of stereo 8-ohm headphones, and you're going to hear almost nothing. Connect it to a loudspeaker, again, you'll hear nothing. So there you've got to do a good job of impedance matching because you've got a high impedance source and flea power to start off with. Okay, Wesley wanted to make a comment on all of the above. N2XJN, on this subject, before we leave it, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Enter again. Yeah, for a certain period of time I was working with the Infinity Brasson system and Boston Acoustics. Three major players. What I have noticed is a very simple factor. I believe that the comparator was not in use in this equipment. It is not used as of today, because I have not seen any changes. When you put two speakers in parallel, what you're going to see, and it's not that you're not going to notice, you're going to immediately notice that the output of the sound is twice louder. At the same time, you're increasing the current that is going through the coils of that speaker at 100%. Now, if you put three speakers, most likely you're going to blow something. And if you connect them in series, then you create 16 ohms resistance, and at that point you have a decrease of the loudness of the speakers on 50%. Back to you.
WV2CQT. WV2CQT. We'll pick you up in a second, sir. I agree with you, Wesley. Many of these audio output amplifiers are extremely forgiving. A few of them will tolerate a short circuit without damage. As you start putting more and more loudspeakers in parallel, and because of the negative feedback, which is sometimes called comparative function and damping function, because the true electronic impedance of the amplifier is a very low number, up until the point you hit maximum deliverable current or maximum deliverable voltage, that final stage of that audio output amplifier cannot exceed some particular voltage, which is proportional to the power supply going to it, and depending on what devices are there, it can't exceed a certain amount of current. But within reason, you can use lower and higher impedances loads by putting them in series and parallel, and yes, when you put them in parallel, it'll deliver the exact same voltage to both loudspeakers, therefore you're getting twice as much power output, twice as much audio. Everything will sound louder. Put them in series, and you're getting half the voltage to each, and they get lower, each one gets, because of half the voltage, they have one quarter the power, but because there's two of them, you end up with half the power. So it does get weaker. But the amplifier is extremely forgiving because of the negative feedback or comparative function. And to some degree, on VHF amplifiers, we can do this. Even on our HF amplifiers, some of them, we can do this. So it's not a showstopper if, in a pinch, you've got to use a T-connector to match two antennas. Okay, before we go to any other subject, let me pick up WB2CQT, I think it was. Not a name, sir. And do you want to be put on the list for somebody with a question? K2RIW in the TechNet. My pick.
Okay, Dick, you have the calls correct. The name is Larry, and it's a different topic. I won't stay on. It was on the news just now that Osama bin Laden may have been killed. That's all right now, and I'll just listen.
KC2ZWQ.
Larry, if that's true, that's extremely significant. ZWQ, go right ahead.
I wanted to ask a question about the E-field antenna, if I may.
Yeah, back up for a little bit here. Larry, what news report were you hearing and do you think it is real as opposed to non-real? If what you're saying is real, that's extremely significant. WB2CQT, what news report was that, Larry? K2LIW in the TechNet?
It was on the John Batchelor radio program that's on 780 AM right now.
Okay, give us a couple of words. Where was he? What are the details of this apparent assassination, if it's real? Back to you, Larry.
I have no details. I was listening to the net, and then I walked into another room where the radio was on, and I just heard it for a minute or two. They say that there may be an announcement from the White House in the near future about it, but we'll have to wait and see.
This KB2DTD, President Obama will be talking to the nation shortly.
Okay, doing permanent damage. Give us some words on that. Go slow. What did you hear, and what's his reason for that?
Because Osama bin Laden evidently was killed, and they're all meeting in secret at the White House right now. But President Obama will be speaking to the nation within the next half hour.
Okay, that's very interesting, Jerry, because I guess he was considered number one on the, I'm going to call it hit list, but you know what I mean. So I guess we don't know any details of that. Okay, so it was Osama bin Laden. I maybe heard incorrectly. I thought I heard Obama, which means our president, is what I thought Larry had just told me. But I guess it's my mishearing. Okay, I'm reasonably disconnected tonight, as you can tell. Mel, is there anyone on the list that I should have covered up till now that I've skipped? Maybe you know better than I do. K2KEY, K2LAW.
No, not really. We were in the middle of the mailbag, and you said pick another one, and then we went completely off to another direction. That's about all. So, all right, well, let's see. Do we miss anything? I guess nothing. I'm looking on my list here. I think we just about covered the whatever we're supposed to, Dick. Over.
Sounds good. Sorry that I didn't get back to one more of the mailbag. And because of the lateness of the hour, it's probably not recommended to go back to the mailbag unless you think you've got somebody who's not a student that's got to go to school tomorrow. What do you think, Mel? Go ahead.
I don't bother with any of the other questions that come from many of people, I could say, in the advanced engineering and other maybe commercial interests in the field. This is not the forum for it, so I only stay with the newcomers to ham radio that have straightforward, simple questions, Dick. So we'll have to leave it for next week. Any of the so-called mailbag, because I think most of them are already sleeping for going to school. I assume most of them are young people, Dick. Over.
Blake from KC2YDT.
Mr. YDT, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to inform you guys, we just got breaking news. If you're near a television set, turn it on, put on Channel 7. They have confirmed that Osama bin Laden has been killed. I repeat, Osama bin Laden has been killed, and that is confirmed. If you're near a television set, put it on, and it will the president will be talking any minute.
Okay, that's Matthew who just gave us that information. Thank you, Matt. Yeah, that is quite significant. Well, I guess people think that he was one of the major architects of the 9/11 incident, which was almost 10 years ago. It looks like that incident has finally come to an end this is all true. Anyone, any further questions or comments on this subject? Give me a call. That is right now.
KC2ZWQ.
ZWQ. Start off with your name, sir, and then your comment.
My name is Andy. I'm a new ham, and I came onto the net just as you mentioned an e-field antenna. I'd like to find out more about it if you can refer me to the correct article.
I wish, Andy, I could tell you exactly which issue of Ham Radio Magazine had it. This was an article, approximately 1980, but I could be plus or minus 5 years wrong. And that's not the only place it has appeared. If you do a Google search on the word voltage probe antenna or e-field antenna, but voltage probe antenna, VPA, voltage probe antenna is probably the most common set of words used for that antenna. You do a Google search on that set of words and slight variations of it, you're going to get a whole lot of articles on that subject, as I see it, Andy. It is a, I won't say it's a popular antenna. It's a relatively rare antenna, but in certain circumstances, extremely effective antenna. Back to you, Andy, for any fill on that. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
I have information. Thanks very much, Dick. That's a good search term that I can use, and I appreciate it very much, and it's a great net, by the way. And KC2ZWQ, good night.
Hi, thank you, Andy. And Andy, you're allowed to come back next week and ask the question again if you don't get enough information from what you've heard so far. You didn't get a complete answer, you're allowed to repeat. Wesley's got some more information. N2XJM, K2RIW. Go ahead, Wesley.
QST of 2001, September, you're going to get it all.
By September 2001, you said?
That is correct.
Yeah, give us a
very much. I appreciate that a lot.
Give us a little bit of a fill. What is the name of that article in September 2001 QST? What's the name of that article, Wes? Go ahead.
I was logging to ARRL, and there was a PDF, but when I click on it, I couldn't, on the link, I couldn't find it, but it is in September 2001 QST magazine, that there is a PDF information about this antenna.
Okay, let's hope Andy is able to open that one up. If you're an ARRL member, you're allowed to go to all of these archives of QST magazine. You'll find that the website of ARRL, in order to get those archives, is a little bit persnickety. There are times when you've got to know the call letters of the author or the date. You've got to know something exact in their form, otherwise it'll say there's no such record. There are times when I've looked for my own articles by way of their website, and I know who I am, I know the name of my article, and it said it doesn't exist. So you have to sign in again, try another time. You gotta keep trying. It's nowhere near as friendly as Google is. In the case of Google, you can have misspelled words in the wrong order, and it asks you the question, did you really mean to ask this? If you know what I mean. Fairly forgiving. Okay, who was it that had another question? There was another person who had a question. I can't remember who it was. You know who you are. K2RIW in the TechNet.
N2XGN. I'm trying to connect a few things together. At first, the solar power without solar cells, a hidden magnetic effect of light, that could make it possible. And the researchers of the Michigan University at April 20th, 2011, so it's brand new, they found the way to make kind of optical battery, and they were able to find out that underestimated component, magnetic component of light, is being amplified through the glass, regular glass, 100 million times. Now,